through a bullhorn, a police captain began to shout,
"Clear the plaza! Clear the plaza!"
The first reports of the annihilation camps were passed on to the OSS by a Swiss businessman, evaluated as being one of the most trustworthy informants on affairs in Nazi Europe. The State Department decided that the stories were not confirmed. That was early in 1943. By autumn of that year, more urgent reports from the same source, transmitted still through the OSS, forced a major policy conference. It was again decided that the reports were not true. As winter began, the English government asked for another conference to discuss similar reports from their own intelligence networks and from the government of Romania. The delegates met in Bermuda for a warm, sunny weekend and decided that the reports were not true. They returned to their work, refreshed and tanned. The death trains continued to roll. Early in 1944, Henry Morgenthau, Jr., Secretary of the Treasury, was reached by dissenters in the State Department, examined the evidence, and forced a meeting with President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Shaken by the assertion in Morgenthau's document, Roosevelt pledged that he would act at once. He never did. It was said later that the State Department convinced him once again of their own analysis. The reports simply were not true. When Mr. Hitler said Vernichtung, he had not really meant Vernichtung. An author, Ben Hecht, then placed an ad in the New York Times, presenting the evidence to the public. A group of prominent rabbis attacked him for alarming Jews unnecessarily and undermining confidence in America's chief executive during wartime. Finally, late that year, American and Russian troops began liberating the camps, and General Eisenhower insisted that news photographers take detailed movies, which were released to the whole world. In the interval between the first suppressed report by the Swiss businessman and the liberation of the first camp, 6 million people had died.
That's what we call a Bavarian fire drill,
Simon explained to Joe. It was another time. He was driving another Volkswagen. In fact, it was the night of April the 23rd, and they were going to meet Tobias Knight at the UN building.
It was one official named Winifred who'd been transferred from the Justice Department to a key State Department desk where every bit of evidence passed for evaluation. But the same principles apply everywhere. For instance, we're half an hour early for the meeting, anyhow. I'll give you an illustration right now.
They were approaching the corner of 43rd Street and 3rd Avenue, and Simon had observed that the street light was changing to red. As he stopped the car, he opened the door and said to Joe,
"Follow me."
Puzzled, Joe got out as Simon ran to the car behind them, beat on the hood with his hand and shouted,
"Bavarian fire drill! Out!"
He made vigorous but ambiguous motions with his hands and ran to the car next back. Joe saw the first subject look dubiously at his companion and then open the door and get out, obediently trailing behind Simon's urgent and somber figure.
Bavarian fire drill! Ow!
Simon was already shouting at the third car back. As Joe trotted along, occasionally adding his own voice to persuade the more dubious drivers, every car gradually emptied and people formed a neat line heading back toward Lexington Avenue. Simon then ducked between two cars and began jogging toward the front of the line at 3rd Avenue again, shouting to everybody,
"Complete circle, stay in line."
Obediently, everyone followed in a great circle back to their own cars, re-entering from the side opposite to that from which they had left. Simon and Joe climbed back into the VW. The light changed, and they sped ahead.
"You see?"
Simon asked.
"Use words they've been conditioned to since childhood, fire drill, stay in line, like that, and never look back to see if they're obeying. They'll follow." Well, that's the way the Illuminati guaranteed that the final solution wouldn't be interrupted. Winifred, one guy who had been around long enough to have an impressive title and his scrawl, "Evaluation, dubious," on the bottom of each memo. And 6 million died. Hilarious, isn't it?
And Joe remembered from the little book by Hagbard Chalene, "Never whistle while you're pissing." privately printed and distributed only to members of the JAMS and the Legion of Dynamic Discord. The individual act of obedience is the cornerstone not only of the strength of authoritarian society, but also of its weakness. On November the 23rd, 1970, the body of Stanislaus Edipuski, 46, of West Living Park Road, was found floating in the Chicago River. Death, according to the police laboratory, did not result from drowning, but from beating about the head and shoulders with a square-ended object. The first inquiries by homicide detectives revealed that Edipuski had been a member of God's Lightning, and the theory was formed that a conflict between the dead man and his former colleagues might have resulted in his being snuffed with their wooden crosses. Further investigation revealed that Edipuski had been a construction worker, and until very recently well-liked on his job, behaving in a normal, down-to-earth manner, bitching about the government, cursing the lazy bums on welfare, hating niggers, shouting obscene remarks at good-looking dolls who pass construction sites, and, when the odds were safely above the 8-to-1 level, joining other middle-aged workers in attacking and beating young men with long hair piece buttons or other un-American stigmata. Then about a month before, all that had changed. He began bitching about the bosses as well as the government, almost sounding like a communist at times. When somebody else cussed the crumbums on welfare, Stan remarked thoughtfully,
"Well, you know, our union keeps them from getting jobs, fellas, so what else can they do but go on welfare? Steal?"
He even said once, when some of the guys were good-humouredly giving the finger and making other gallant noises and signals towards a passing 18-year-old girl,
"Hey, you know, that might really be embarrassing and scaring her."
Worse yet, his own hair began to grow surprisingly long in the back, and his wife told friends that he didn't look at TV much anymore, but instead sat in a chair most evenings, reading books. The police found that was indeed true, and his small library, gathered in less than a month, was remarkable indeed, featuring works on astronomy, sociology, oriental mysticism, Darwin's Origin of the Species, detective novels by Raymond Chandler, Alice in Wonderland, and a college-level text on number theory, with a section on primes heavily marked with notes in the margin. The gallant and now pathetic tracks of a mind that was beginning to grow after four decades of stagnation, and then had been abruptly stomped. Most mysterious of all was the card found in the dead man's pocket, which, although waterlogged, could still be read. One side said, "There is no enemy anywhere." On the other side, even more mysteriously, was inscribed with various symbols. The police might have tried to decipher this, but then they discovered that Edipuski had resigned from God's Lightning, giving his fellow members a lecture on tolerance in the process the night before his death. That closed the case, definitely. Homicide did not investigate murders clearly connected with God's Lightning, since the Red Squad had its own personal accommodation with the burgeoning organization.
"Poor motherfucker,"
a detective said, looking at Edipuski's photographs, and closed the file forever. Nobody ever reopened it, or traced the change in the dead man back to his attendance at the meeting 1 month before of KCUF at the Sheraton, Chicago, where the punch was spiked with Aum.
In the act of conception, of course, the father contributes 23 chromosomes and the mother contributes another 23. In the I Ching hexagram, 23 has connotations of sinking or breaking apart, shades of the unfortunate Captain Clark's. Another woman just came by, collecting for the Mother's March Against Muscular Dystrophy. I gave her a quarter. Where was I? Oh, yes. James Joyce had 5 letters in both his front name and his hind name, so he was worth looking into. A Portrait of the Artist has 5 chapters, all well and good, but Ulysses has 18 chapters, a stumper until I remembered that 5 plus 18 equals 23. How about Finnegan's Wake? Alas, that has 17 chapters, and I was bogged down for a while. Trying another angle, I wondered if Frank Sullivan, The poor cluck who got shot instead of John at the Biograph Theater that night could have lingered until after midnight, dying on July 23rd instead of July 22nd, as usually stated. I looked it up in Toland's book, The Dillinger Days. Poor Frank, sad to say, died before midnight, but Toland included an interesting detail, which I told you that night at the seminary bar. 23 people died of heat prostration that day in Chicago. He added something else. 17 people had died of heat prostration the day before. Why did he mention that? I'm sure he doesn't know. But there it was again, 23 and 17. Maybe something important is going to happen in the year 2317. I couldn't check that, of course. You can't navigate precisely in the Morgan's Heute Gestirnwelt. So I went back to 1723 and struck golden apples. That was the year Adam Smith and Adam Weishaupt were both born, and Smith published The Wealth of Nations the same year Weishaupt revived the Illuminati, 1776. Well, 2 + 3 = 5, fitting the law of fives, but 1 + 7 = 8, fitting nothing. Where did that leave me? 8, I reflected, is the number of letters in Callisti. Back to the golden apple again. And 8 is also 2 to the power of 3. Hot damn! Naturally, it came as no surprise when the 8 defendants in the Chicago conspiracy trial, which grew out of our little convention week carnival, were tried on the 23rd floor of the federal building amid a flurry of synchronicity. A Hoffman among the defendants, a Hoffman as judge, the Illuminati pyramid or great seal of the U.S. right inside the door of the building, and a scale getting worse abuse than the other defendants. 5-letter names and proliferating. Abby, Davis, Foran, Scale, Jerry Rubin twice, and the clincher, Clark, Ramsey, not captain, who was torpedoed and sunk by the judge before he could testify. I got interested in Dutch Schultz because he died on October 23rd. A cluster of synchronicity, that man. He ordered the shooting of Vincent Mad Dog Carl. Remember Mad Dog, Texas? Carl was shot on 23rd Street when he was 23 years old, and Charlie Workman, who allegedly shot Schultz, served 23 years in prison for it, although rumor has it that Mendy Weiss, 2 5-letter names again, did the real shooting. Does 17 come in? You bet. Schultz was first sentenced to prison at the age of 17. Around this time, I brought Robert Heinlein's The Puppet Masters, thinking the plot might parallel some Illuminati operations. Imagine how I felt when Chapter 2 began 23 hours and 17 minutes ago, a flying saucer landed in Iowa.
And in New York, Peter Jackson is trying to get the next issue of Confrontation out on time. Although the office is still a shambles, the editor and star researcher have disappeared, the best reporter has gone ape and claims to be at the bottom of the Atlantic with a wax tycoon. And the police are hounding Peter to find out why the first two detectives assigned to the case can't be located. Sitting in his apartment, now the magazine's office, in his shirt and shorts, Peter dials his phone with one hand, adding another crushed cigarette to the pile in the ashtray with the other. Throwing a manuscript into a basket marked Ready for Printer, he crosses off lead article, The Youngest Student Ever Admitted to Columbia Tells Why He Dropped Out by L.L. Durruti, from a list on the pad before him. His pencil moves down to the bottom, Book Review, as he listens to the phone ring. Finally, he hears the click of a lifted receiver and a rich, fluty voice says,
Epicene Wildblood here? Got your book review ready, Epi? Have it tomorrow, dear boy. Can't be any faster, honestly. Tomorrow will do.
Peter says, writing, Call again, AM, next to book review.
It's a dreadfully long monster of a book,
Wildblood says pettishly.
And I certainly won't have time to read it, but I'm giving it a thorough skimming. The authors are utterly incompetent, no sense of style or structure at all. It starts out as a detective story, switches to science fiction, then goes off into supernatural. and is full of the most detailed information of dozens of ghastly, boring subjects. And the time sequence is all out of order in a very pretentious imitation of Faulkner and Joyce. Worse yet, it has the most raunchy sex scenes thrown in just to make it sell, I'm sure. And the authors, whom I've never heard of, have the supreme bad taste to introduce real political figures into this mishmash and pretend to be exposing a real conspiracy. You can be sure I won't waste time reading such rubbish. But I'll have a perfectly devastating review ready for you by tomorrow noon.
Well, we don't expect you to read every book you review,
Peter says mollifyingly.
Just so long as you can be entertaining about them.
The Foot Fetishist Liberation Front will be participating in the rally at the UN building,
Jam Alex said as George and Peter and he were affixing their black armbands.
Christ,
Jackson said disgustedly.
We can't afford to take that attitude,
Jay said severely.
The only hope for the left at this time is coalition politics. We can't exclude anybody who wants to join us.
I've got nothing against faggots, personally.
Peter begins.
Gays,
Jay says patiently.
I've got nothing against gays, personally.
Peter goes on.
But they are a bring down at rallies. They just give God's lightning more evidence to say we're all a bunch of fruits. But okay. Realism is realism. There are a lot of them, and they swell our ranks and all that. But Jesus, Joe, these toe freaks are a splinter within a splinter. They're microscopic. Don't call them toe freaks,
Joe says.
They don't like that.
A woman from the Mother's March Against Psoriasis just came by with another collection box. I gave her a quarter, too. The marching mothers are going to strip Moon of his bread if this keeps up. Where was I? I meant to add, in relation to the Dutch Schultz shooting, that Marty Crompier, who ran the policy racket in Harlem, was also shot on October 23, 1935. The police asked him if there was a connection with the phlegmatic Flegenheimer's demise, and he said, "It's got to be one of them coincidences." I wonder how he emphasized that. One of them coincidences, or one of them coincidences? How much did he know? That brings me to the 40 enigma. As I pointed out, 1 plus 7 equals 8, the number of letters in Callisti. 8 times 5 equals 40. More interestingly, without invoking the mystic 5, we still arrive at 40 by adding 17 plus 23. What, then, is the significance of 40? I've run through various associations. Jesus had his 40 days in the desert, Ali Baba and his 40 thieves, Buddhists have their 40 meditations, the solar system is almost exactly 40 astronomical units in radius, Pluto yo-yos a bit, but I have no definite theory yet.
The colour television set in the Three Lions pub in the Tudor Hotel at 42nd Street and 2nd Avenue shows the white-helmeted men carrying wooden crosses fall back as the blue-helmeted men carrying billy clubs move forward. The CBS camera pans over the plaza. There are 5 bodies on the ground, scattered like flotsam tossed on a beach by a receding wave. 4 of them are moving, making slow efforts to get up. The 5th is not moving at all. George said,
I think that's the guy we saw getting clubbed. My God, I hope he isn't dead.
Joe Malik said,
if he is dead, he may get people to demand that something be done about God's lightning.
Peter Jackson laughed mirthlessly.
You still think some hunky peacenik getting killed is going to make people indignant? Don't you understand? Nobody in this country cares what happens to a peace freak. You're in the same boat with the niggers now, you silly sons of bitches.
Carlos looked up in astonishment as I burst into the room, still wet from the Passaic, and threw the gun at his feet, screaming,
you silly sons of bitches, you can't even make bombs without blowing yourselves up. And when you buy a gun, the motherfucker is defective and misfires. You can't expel me. I quit, you silly sons of bitches. You silly sons of bitches,
Simon shouted. Joe woke as the VW swerved amid a flurry of Hell's Angels bikes roaring by. He was back in real time again. But the word had quotes round it in his mind now, and it always would.
Wow,
he said.
I was in Chicago again, and then at that rock festival, and then I was in somebody else's lifeline.
Goddamn Harley Davidsons,
Simon mutters as the last angel thunders by.
When 50 or 60 of them swarm by like that, it's as bad as trying to drive on the sidewalk in Times Square at high noon without hitting a pedestrian.
Later for that,
Joe said, conscious of his growing ease in using Simon's own language.
This tomorrow, today, yesterday time is beginning to get under my skin. It's happening more and more often.
Simon sighed.
You want words to put around it. You can't accept it unless it has labels dangling off it, like a new suit. Okay. And your favorite word game is science. Fine. Right on. Tomorrow we'll drop by the main library and you can look up the English science journal Nature for Summer, 1966. There's an article in there by the University College physicist F.R. Stannard about what he calls the Faustian universe. He tells how the behavior of K-mesons can't be explained assuming a one-way time track, but fits into a neat pattern if you assume our universe overlaps another where time runs in the opposite direction. He calls it the Faustian universe, but I'll bet he has no idea that Goethe wrote Faust after experiencing that universe directly, just as you're doing lately. Incidentally, Stannard points out that everything in physics is symmetrical, except our present concept of one-way time. Once you admit two-way time traffic, you've got a completely symmetrical universe. Fits the Occamite's demand for simplicity. Stannard will give you lots of words, man. Meanwhile, just settle for what Abdul al-Hazred wrote in the Necronomicon. Past, present, future. All are one. In Yog-Sothoth, or what Weishaupt wrote in his Königin Kirchen und Dummheit. There is but one eye, and it is all eyes. One mind, it is all minds. One time, and it is now. Grok?
Joe nods dubiously, faintly hearing the music. Rama, 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 Hare.
Two big rhinoceroses, three big rhinoceroses.
Dillinger made contact with the mind of Richard Belts, 43-year-old professor of physics at Queen's College, as Belts was being loaded into an ambulance to be taken to Bellevue Hospital, where X-rays would reveal severe skull fractures. Shit, Dillinger thought. Why does somebody have to be half dead before I can reach him? Then he concentrated on his message. Two universes flowing in opposite directions. Two together form a third entity which is synergetically more than the sum of its two parts. Thus two always leads to three. Two and three. Duality and trinity. Every unity is a duality and a trinity, a pentagon, sheer energy, no matter involved. From the pentagon depends five more pentagons, like the petals of a flower, a white rose. Five petals and a centre, six, two times three. The flower interlocks with another flower just like it, forming a polyhedron made of pentagons. Each such polyhedron could have common surfaces with other polyhedrons, forming infinite latticework based on the pentagonal unit. They would be immortal, self-sustaining, not computers, beyond computers, gods, all the space for their habitation, infinitely complex. The howl of a siren reached the unconscious ears of Professor Belts. Consciousness is present in the living body, even in one that is apparently unconscious. Unconsciousness is not the absence of consciousness, but its temporary immobility. It is not a state resembling death. It is not like death at all. Once the necessary complexity of brain cell interconnections is reached, substantial energy relationships are set up. These can exist independently of the material base that brought them into being. All of this, of course, is merely visual structural metaphor for interactions on the energy level that cannot be visualized. The siren howled. In the Three Lions pub, George said to Peter,
"What was in that water pistol?"
"Sulfuric acid."
"Acid is just the first stage,"
says Simon.
"Like matter is the first stage of life and consciousness.
acid launches you. But once you're out there, if the mission is successful, you jettison the first stage and you're traveling free of gravity, which means free of matter. Acid dissolves the barriers which prevent the maximum possible complexity of energy relationships from building up in the brain. At Norton Cabal, we show you how to pilot the second stage.
Waving their crosses over their heads and howling incoherently, the men of God's lightning formed wavering ranks and marched around the territory they had conquered. Zev Hirsch and Frank Ochuk carried the banner that read, "Love it or we'll stomp you."